Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Robert Elliott, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Perin Gurel about her new book, The Limits of Westernization, A Cultural History of America and Turkey. Hi, Dr. Gurel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Perin, I wonder if you can begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I was born in Istanbul, Turkey in 1981, very specific, February 1981. But that was during military rule, actually, following the 1980 coup, which, as your listeners probably know, realigned Turkish society in pretty significant ways. So I grew up during a time that I explore in the later chapters of the book, a time of rising American influence on Turkish politics, economy, and culture under Turgut Özal's government. I also went to an American high school in Turkey, which established my understanding of the United States, this distant empire that somehow seemed so present and was really beginning to influence the way I built up my own identity as a modern Turkish girl. So after 2 years at two different Turkish universities as an English major, I transferred to UC Berkeley as an international transfer student. And there I discovered American studies, this interdisciplinary field that I ended up getting my PhD in at Yale in 2011. And I'm currently assistant professor of American studies at the University of Notre Dame. I specialize in transnational American studies with focus on U.S. and the Middle East. So it's pretty cool to be on a New Books in Middle East podcast.
Hey, well, we're very glad to have you on. So how did you come upon this this specific topic? Did this have to do with your upbringing, or was there something else that led to your interest in this?
Yeah, I think, as I said, growing up in Turkey in the 1980s and 1990s had a lot to do with it. As I noted, America loomed very large in our everyday life, specifically regarding discussions around westernization or batılaşma. And we also learned about the United States in school in our history classes, specifically about this thing called the American Mandate, Amerikan Mandası, which was a part of the discussion about the reordering of the world after World War I, where our teacher told us that Turkey was maybe almost going to be a U.S. colony, but then we fought back, etc. So then I came to the United States and I decided to study American history and culture. And I thought, this is it. I will finally find out what batılaşma is all about, westernization, and what this mandate question is. And of course, none of that was on offer at all. It wasn't even on the radar for American historians, historians of U.S. foreign policy even. So I thought, wow, what is going on? How is it that the things that I thought most defined the United States are not a part of the conversation of American studies? And at the same time, there's this new subfield called transnational American studies, examining the world in the United States and the U.S. and the world was on the rise. And there were increasing calls for a type of American studies that seriously engages with non-U.S. representations of the United States and Americanness. So I thought I might have a role to play here. And every class I took in graduate school, I tried to write something about how debates over westernization in other parts of the world and their writing of history can help us understand the U.S. and the world. And that's how the project was born. I really wanted to look at these different representations and why parts of these narratives were missing from official American history and American studies.
And on this topic of Westernization, you introduced this term, wild Westernization. Can you tell us a bit about what you mean by this?
Sure. I think the best way to think about wild Westernization for me and the need to kind of conceptualize or offer a new term was to contrast it with the two terms that actually do exist in the literature. A lot of the book is interdisciplinary, builds on different Turkish engagements with the question of Westernization. So the terms that do exist, the first one is what scholars have called authoritarian modernization, or what we might think of as selective or authoritarian Westernization, which is a state and elite-directed project of social engineering, which is really most closely associated with the Kemalist government of the early 20th century, where you incorporate different political practices, different ways of dress, different modes of being, even different ways of sort of sitting on a chair into the country to selectively modernize it, to bring it in line with what others would call contemporary civilization. So that's selective Westernization or authoritarian modernization. So we have a huge scholarship around that, especially in history. And then we have a huge scholarship on the literature side on so-called over-Westernization, sometimes called super-Westernization or West-oxication, which is, again, this look from top down, worrying about the degenerating influence of Westernization measures and attempting to control it. So while both of these things are going on, I wanted to talk about the other thing that's going on, which is what we might think of as vernacular transculturation with the West. So wild Westernization for me is a term for the types of cultural contact and influence with the West that were not foreseen by Turkish leaders who set out to properly modernize or strategically Westernize the country and its peoples in the early 20th century. So it is my term for the mess of what happens when cultures interact and intersect and transform across power hierarchies, and specifically about the types of vernacular transculturation with the United States that followed on the heels of World War II. This wide-scale transculturation of Western, specifically American cultural exports, with the local vernacular. So for me, wild Westernization, as you can tell from the name, is this vernacular cultural reality that cannot be controlled by policymakers in Turkey or the United States. It's a hybridization process with effects that are sometimes vulgar, sometimes sort of resigned to capitalism, sometimes defined of authority, but ultimately unpredictable. And some of the processes that I label as wild Westernization or vernacular transculturation have been critiqued as wrong or over-Westernization by Turkish authors. So wrong Westernization, yanlış batılılaşma, or over-Westernization, aşırı batılılaşma, to use the Turkish terms. And I wanted to reject the moralizing inherent in those designations while also showing the broader reality and politics of cultural transformation. And of course, it puns with the Wild West. And a big part of wild Westernization that I explore in the book is how these ideas about what the Wild West also begin to influence Turkish cultural production.
I really enjoyed that part of the book. You have a wonderful hook regarding these kind of forms of cultural production, and I was reading the book and I started giggling like a madman
as That's I was so great. Like
going through the first few pages.
Oh yeah. The language can be strong, but I owe so much to that concept of wild Westernization. I really owe it to my love of Turkish popular culture, especially Turkish humor, Turkish comedy. I think these sort of popular thinkers worked out what it meant to try to draw the limits of Westernization and to fail, and how sort of ridiculous that endeavor is. Thank you for pointing. I do think the book ended up being kind of funny because of that focus, and specifically that comedy scene that I opened with, the Yashi Batı movie, which I recommend to all listeners. It's a really great piece of humor that engages with the idea of America through the Ottoman Empire in an interesting way.
And on a slightly different note, In chapter one, you speak a lot about Halide Edip and the Wilsonian Principles League. Can you tell us a little bit about Halide Edip, who she is, and how she fits within this narrative?
Sure. Halide Edip Adıvar, she's a very significant player in this question, really the debates about Westernization, but specifically this question that comes up right after World War I, which is the question of a U.S. mandate over Turkey. This is was a big part of our history books in Turkey that completely wasn't on the radar, as I said, in the United States. But Halide Edip, she's a very highly educated woman, an accomplished author from an elite background. And right after World War I, as the Ottoman Empire is kind of lost the war and you don't know what the future holds, she founds this organization called the Wilsonian Principles League that initially argues for sovereignty under Wilsonian principles. And after the setup of the mandate system, she begins to lobby for a U.S. mandate over the remainders of the Ottoman Empire. So she and like-minded intellectuals believe that the United States at this time would be a really good guide for the Ottoman Empire towards modernity, and that the United States doesn't have these imperialistic designs on the Middle East, on their lands, unlike Europe, really every major power. So they think it would be good to become sort of like an American protectorate until they can kind of stand up on their own. Woodrow Wilson is not a fan of this idea. He's not a fan of Turks, that really doesn't want to have it anything to do with Turks. And she's also kept on the sidelines by Mustafa Kemal, who kind of humors her letters, but really doesn't push too much this angle. And she actually, within a year, ends up joining the nationalist resistance. So she becomes an important part of that nationalist struggle. So, as I said, the question of the mandate is huge in Turkish nationalist rhetoric and history, and Halide Edip plays an oversized role in this, since she eventually gets cast as this over-Westernized traitor, this woman in bed with the West, first by Mustafa Kemal, who gives a speech in Turkish parliament called Nutuk, claiming that a lot of these intellectuals who were a part of the nationalist resistance were actually in line with the West and don't need to be part of the Republic. So he establishes this depiction of Halide Edip as a questionable, sort of over-Westernized traitor. And then, of course, much of nationalist history is based on Nutuk, so it repeats the story. So gender is a huge part of how these debates over Westernization emerged. So the chapter tells the story of the question of the mandate, what happened, and the competing Turkish and U.S. nationalist histories through the figure of Halide Edip. And I also talk about how representations of Halide Edip changed in the early 20th century. She's a sort of venerable figure. Really, by the 1970s, as anti-Americanism is on the rise, her statue is bombed because she is seen as an example of some intellectual, elite intellectual who argues for U.S. imperialism over Turkey. So it's all about these debates around her figure. And a part of it was published in American Quarterly, in case any of your readers want to check it out.
Yeah, I hope they do. Halide Edip, she's really an interesting and complicated figure, and I've always found it interesting the various styles of critiques that have been leveled against her based on gender, religion.
Yes.
Which I forgot who it was, but I think you mentioned the book that people kind of lambast her because her characters tend to fall for like Europeans. And when I just read Sinekli Bakal the other week, and Peregrini converts to Islam. Okay, so I mean, like, he's playing ball, so
it doesn't count. Yeah, she actually converts him. I mean, it's just this amazing book. So normally, it's really amazing because she also wrote these nationalist novels that get assigned in Turkish literature classes. So you have Turkish literature classes that are saying, read this woman's novels to become better Turks. And then you have Turkish history classes that are saying, this woman was terrible and like was a terrible Turk, you know, not in the sense that Wilson understood the terrible Turk, but was just really westernized. And, you know, and then you have stuff like this author who basically says, no, even when you look at these literary classics, you see that she's in love with the West and doesn't, you know, so it is these multiple levels of critique, and she is such a fascinating figure. I agree with you.
Great. So literature and popular culture play a pretty strong role in this text. And in chapter two, you look at a wide array of literature from the late Ottoman period onwards. So how do these novels depict the dangers of over-Westernization, and what sort of archetypes and tropes do we see?
So the book, as you say, kind of follows this rhetorical line from official to less official, from expressly political to stuff that is seen as less political. So that I place the novel between the official and the vernacular because it played such a political role. And just as in chapter one, I build on the work of Turkish historians. In chapter two, I build on the work of amazing Turkish literary scholars such as Bernam Oran, Jale Parla, Sibel Orzak, who have offered readings of the Turkish novel as a space where gendered anxieties about Westernizations played out. Not much of that work focuses on Europe. So I wanted to see how these worries about over-Westernization, which I really developed in the late Ottoman period, as you note, in the high age of European imperialism, transformed once the United States entered the game at the turn of the century and really began to dominate it by the middle of the 20th century. So a lot of figures shift. So in the late Ottoman era, we already begin to see a shift in the dynamics and register of over-Westernization from comical, like with the figure of the dandy who is in love with Europe, and he's kind of a humorous figure, a failure. So you transition from the late 19th century to the early 20th century from this comical figure of the dandy to the tragic figure of the West-toxicated fallen young women, which, of course, that corresponds with the empire's literal invasion by sort of the beloved West. But we also watch America, the United States, kind of enter into the Turkish novel during this time, initially as the lesser of two evils. So you have Europeans, and then you have Americans who are also problematic, but not as bad as the Europeans in the 1920s, 1930s. So, for example, in Kara Osmanoğlu's famous novel, Sodom and Gomorrah, sort of Europeanness is associated with rape and sodomy, and Americanness is associated with the sort of light lesbianism. You know, gender and sexuality play a huge role in how these limits are getting drawn and how nations and their power are getting figured. But initially, America is like kind of the lesser of two evils, which is also the language used in calling for a mandate in the early 20th century. But eventually, it develops into the sort of most dangerous source of West toxification as the century progresses in the 60s and on. Towards the end of the century, we also begin to have novels which refuse to enforce the boundaries of Westernization. One of the novels that I look at is Orhan Pamuk's New Life, which kind of complicates these ideas about strategic Westernization, over-Westernization, etc., and just kind of is a mess, represents wild Westernization, really, in a really apt way. But it's ironic then that Orhan Pamuk himself gets cast as an over-Westernized traitor, again, through this sort of gendered class and language that also relates to religion, kind of like he's also seen as a crypto-Jew. So the novel initially gets recruited into this project of establishing the limits of Westernization, figuratively drawing them via gender and class, but exceeds these goals. And it also begins to operate as a forum to challenge the state's allegorical impulse and the very attempt to draw these boundaries, and becomes a beautiful archive, I think, of vernacular transculturation. But this is not a progress narrative. I made it sound like one. But even as some novelists are doing this sort of complicating in the early 21st century, we then at the same time have the rise of the ultra-nationalist novels like Metal Fortuna, The Metal Storm, that continue to be very much invested in drawing the limits of Westernization over gender and sexuality.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in chapter 3, you explore something that you called Turklish. Can you explain to our listeners a bit about what you mean by this and how this type of language is used?
Sure. So Turklish is just my translation of Türkçe. A lot of these terms are my attempts to translate vernacular Turkish terms. So this is one example of that. Türkçe is the term that begins to be used in the late 60s, late 70s. It's basically about mixtures of Turkish and English that manifest in everyday speech. And they can be used in a variety of ways, advertising, humor, protests, in protest slogans. But what I focus in on this chapter is how it's used to create humor. So I think maybe I can best explain it with a joke from my childhood. And the joke that was told in these sort of primary schools when I was growing up in the 1990s is, what city in Turkey has the most automobiles? Do you know which one?
Cars.
Cars, yes. So that is the joke. I think so. It's obviously a pun, right? On cars, the city, and cars, you know, automobiles. And so this is basically a pun, and it also kind of talks about, it has ideas about modernization, right? Cars is not seen as like the most modern city. You would think it would be Istanbul, but it turns out to be cars. So there are multiple layers to these basic Turklish texts. So, and this is a very small pun, but there are many varieties of Turklish, and I reproduced even this long epic romance that builds on direct translations of Turkish proverbial expressions, like sort of false translations of proverbs, tells this extensive story about these star-crossed lovers that replicates kind of Yeşilçam movies, classical Turkish movies. So this chapter actually was the first extensive study that I could find that I had to produce of Turklish humor. But of course, I was studying it again with an eye to how these texts reflect wild westernization or vernacular transculturation with the United States, and how Turklish might also be used in an oppositional manner as well to critique selective westernization, but even to kind of talk back to empire, to talk back to the United States.
And in chapter 4, you discuss transvesti people. Can you explain to our listeners who these people are and how the discourse regarding them and gay people relate to over and under Westernization?
So this chapter was very difficult to write, partially because of these terms. And as with the other chapters, I foregrounded popular understandings of categorizations that, of course, differ from the many ways people identify or don't identify in terms of gender identity and sexual object choice. But what I'm doing in this chapter is basically I wanted to look at the civilizational discourses that were forming around male sexual identities or figures in the 1990s and early 2000s. So again, to explain sort of travesti identity, I have to talk about these two other identities around which there's extensive civilizational discourse during this period. So you have gay identity, sometimes written with an E in the middle, sometimes with an A. This is this identity that's associated with the West or Westernization, with upper class status, sometimes with over-Westernization. Then you have travesti identity, which is again the public term a popular term, which is imposed on and sometimes adopted by people who are assigned male at birth and may wear feminine attire and are engaged in sex work. So it's like, it's basically a job description of sorts and doesn't really tell us too much about really how those people identify. But these are people who are assigned male at birth and work as sex workers and some type of sort of transition to femininity, either in attire or in other ways. It's a category that really doesn't map onto our contemporary understandings. It's a very classed category. Then you have this concept of the active male partner, which is really a non-identity, but it's used to refer to the supposedly working class partners of gay men and travesti. So the point of looking at these identities was that you could see how some of these debates around the limits of Westernization were taking place on the ground in what types of sexualities people were saying were appropriate, were properly Western or properly Turkish, and which ones were being seen as over-Westernized or really inadequately modern. So at this time, you have really enlightened journalists and some gay activists accusing travesti and active men of being inadequately modern, that there's this sort of teleological narrative that, like, as we modernize, all of these identities are going to fall by the wayside and everyone's going to be gay. It's going to be great. And at the same time, you transition to the first era of AKP rule, sort of this era of moderate Islam, where the AKP is leading the efforts to enter the European Union. So you have the state beginning to think about how it can use some modicum of acceptance of gay identities and sort of gay and lesbian visibility to further support its attempt to enter the European Union and to prove its moderate sort of tolerant status. Again, this is under early AKP rule, where a lot of these sort of LGBTQ clubs even get official state recognition. And even as the state is doing that, it works to evict travesti out of its modern cities, right? So it is kind of buying into this discourse that these people are beyond the pale of proper Westernization. At the same time, you have debates within the LGBTQ community about the role of the West, Westernization, getting funds from the West. And so they're having debates around these identities and also about the politics. And a part of the research for this was built on interviews that I did with LGBTQ activists. So ultimately, the chapter demonstrates that how just as debates over the limits of Westernization were drawn in gendered and sexualized terms with those figurations, gendered and sexual identities in Turkey have been interpreted along an axis of Westernization. So it was kind of looking at the other side of it, how much these debates are gendered and sexualized and how much ideas about gender and sexuality are informed by ideas about Westernization.
So now that this book has been out for a little while, have your thoughts on any of these topics started to change?
So the book has been out for a while. It's also coming out in paperback this spring with Columbia University Press. So I wanted to announce that. You know, I recently wrote a blog post called Turkey, White Supremacy and the Clash of Civilizations in response to some of the sort of the Christchurch shooting and that the shooters, the terrorists' sort of obsession with Ottoman Empire and Istanbul and attempts to draw like different civilizations and kick Turkey out of Europe or not let, kick literally the part of Turkey that is in the continent of Europe out. So I don't want to foreground this guy's sort of delusions, but it was amazing to me how much of this initial drive for the book was to counter simplistic ways of approaching culture and politics, simplistic understandings of culture and politics and understandings of the West and non-West, how much of those remain relevant and how much of those have sort of found their assault weapons in the internet age. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done around those understandings that the book does speak to. However, I also think many things have changed First and foremost, although ideas about modernists remain incredibly relevant to day-to-day Turkish politics and construction of identities, and Turkey continues to have this love-hate relationship with the United States, I think the word Westernization itself has practically disappeared. I don't think it has the same traction, the same heat that it used to have in the 20th century. So it has disappeared, I think, both as a positive term, something we should aspire towards, but also as a negative term in some ways. We're using new terminology. So I'm glad that the book was able to track a significant part of the history of that concept and to highlight the debates over it. And a lot of those debates themselves, I believe, are raging, but somehow the term is missing. And I wish someone would write a whole other book on the term's loss of traction and what terms people are using right now and why in the sort of second era of AKP rule.
And so now that this book is complete, do you have any advice that you would give for a new scholar who's either working on their dissertation or who's doing their first book project?
So the advice depends so much on the field, but I guess the first thing to say is that it's important to mark where you are in your field, where you entered the conversation from. What are the fields that you're in conversation with? What are your key terms? What key debates are you responding to, and how you want to further that conversation? That is really important in sort of contributing to the debates and also being able to organize a whole book around the debates. I also think it's probably a good idea to think in terms of chapters and how the chapters work together to construct a story or a narrative that is going to motivate the reader to read further. Sometimes if it's history, it's a little easier to see that narrative than if it's literature, for example, a literary study. But it helps to think again in terms of sort of what's changing, what threads are shifting from chapter to chapter. And then finally, if you can put fart jokes into your book like I have, don't shy away from that, please, by all means. Put fart jokes into your book. I have a whole, and I was, one of my proud moments was in the index where flatulence has its place. Multiple references to flatulence in that chapter on Turklish, on Turklish humor. So it's one of my problems. So have fun. I guess that's kind of the have fun. And, you know, don't be afraid to be ridiculous in some ways and be funny. But I don't know, maybe listen to your advisor. Maybe, yeah, not too many fart jokes. Consult your advisor about the percentage of fart jokes that are allowable in your book.
I don't think there should be a limit, but
no.
you had a few good Nasreddin Hoca ones.
Yes.
And I forgot what the line is, but there's a golden line somewhere in that chapter about Nasreddin Hoca, and I really urge all of the listeners to get the book just so that they can read that chapter and try to find this, because I'm reading it and I'm just giggling to myself, and I'm thinking, I have to remember this, and I have to tell my friends about this later. They're going to love this.
Is it the word where he's at the he's at an Arab sheikh's house and he's eating food? Is that the one or other something else where he farts? I'm not going to reveal the joke. Buy the book. Is that the one? No.
It's, you frame it something about something to do with flatulence and resistance or something like that.
Yeah.
And just the
we'll leave it that way. Buy the book if you want to follow this thread of flatulence and resistance.
I mean, maybe that could inspire someone's dissertation topic. They're trying to figure out what they want to do.
And if that is your book, I will buy it. I want to, once I get tenure, this is exclusive to this podcast, and I don't want anyone to steal this idea, but I am going to write a book called The Bidet, A Civilizational History. So I'm trademarking it right now. I will take this flatulence thing further towards excretion and methods of cleaning up excretion. This, now the podcast is going to ish, so I'll stop.
Oi.
Sorry.
So on the topic of that, as is the traditional final question on New Books and Middle Eastern Studies podcast, what are you working on right now?
Okay, I do want to work on the B'day book, but that's not, I'm not working on it right now because I don't have tenure. But my second book project does emerge out of this book. So in this book, I was responding to this call, as I said, by American Studies folks to talk about how people outside the United States have talked back, have responded to dominant negative stereotypes, and have anticipated, contested, modified these representations. So the book, The Limits of Westernization, was about putting Orientalism in conversation with Occidentalism or Westernization. And for my second book project, I wanted to investigate the nationalist limits of those counter-hegemonic responses. So I'm specifically looking at the influence of U.S.-led political discourses and associated mass media representations on Turkey-Iran relations from the Cold War to the War on Terror. The book is titled, the second book is titled America's Wife, America's Concubine, Turkey, Iran, and the Bounds of Middle Eastern Solidarity. That title comes from the Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Shah, the last Shah, who once complained to Kennedy that America treats Turkey as a wife and Iran as a concubine. So I'm taking those figured language, the gendered language, very seriously. And specifically, I'm looking at comparatism as a mode of knowledge generation and political strategy. So I'm examining which political actors have mobilized comparative representations of Turkey and Iran and under what terms. How did comparatism operate in rhetorically connecting the two countries, but also maybe limiting the possibilities of solidarity against imperialism? And I'm also investigating the role U.S. hegemony played in these projections.
That sounds like a really great project, and I'm hoping that once that's out, we can have you back on the podcast, and we can have another conversation about that one.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, Perrin, we've taken up a lot of your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time.
And again, the book is The Limits of Westernization, A Cultural History of America and Turkey by Perrin Gürel. And goodbye for now.